Joining me in the studio today is Roy Peter Clark, a longtime faculty member at the Poynter Institute. Still keeps an office there and an office at the Banyan Cafe on Central Avenue in St. Pete. And we're looking at media as continuing our series on St. Pete 2.0. What do we need to present to our citizens in terms of news and media to be a next-tier city? And I think it'd be interesting, since you've had such a long history with news in the area, to get your take on sort of where we've come and what the trajectory looks like from your first days here until present day.
People sometimes criticize newspapers as having been sort of slow to change. And that slowness, one argument goes, like really hurt them in the advent of the digital age. So the idea is that people came into their kitchen and while they weren't paying attention, like stole all their food, such as classified advertising, right? Craigslist. And, you know, the question's often like, why didn't newspapers do this? Why didn't they do that? You know, I'm not sure anybody was capable of, even futurists, capable of seeing ahead far enough to be able to determine how disruptive digital revolutions would become and what that would do to many, many institutions and businesses. Forget about news for a second. Let's talk about the music business, right? So a minute ago, I heard a little sound, and I, like a Pavlov's dog, I reached for my cell phone to see my son-in-law is asking me, how are you liking the Taylor? Now, it's not like Taylor Swift. I bought a new Taylor guitar, and Chaz is a great bass player, so he wants to know. iHeartRadio has wishing me show your pride all month with the perfect soundtrack. This was a sort of, I guess, when I came to St. Petersburg 40 years ago, who knew I would be so dependent and compelled to attach myself to this particular technology? So in a way, I want to take at least newspapers off the hook a little bit. The problem for newspapers, especially newspapers like the St. Petersburg Times, the Tampa Tribune, which doesn't exist anymore. You know, the Tampa Bay Times is the new name for it. But the large regional newspapers, which were monopolies in the 60s, 70s, to the 80s, and were highly valued. We used to say they were printing money. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they had a very, very viable business model. They could sell that paper to you every day for a coin, knowing that the gold bullion would come in from advertisers, right? Who really generated something like 80, 85% of the revenues. Mm-hmm. So much of that advertising has been lost now, not just because of the internet, but because of many other forces. Mass media has become fragmented in so many different ways. How do you in any way regain some of those revenues? Can you do it if you have the best newspaper website in the world? Are you capable of gaining advertising dollars that way? So there's a tremendous amount of confusion all over the country and all over the world, and nobody has successfully been able to answer the question of who will pay for quality journalism this year, 5 years from now, 10 years from now.
Putting maybe newspapers back on the hook a little bit, it's fair to say that futurists might not have seen that 40 years ago, but what about 30, 20, 10, 5 years ago?
Sure.
And, you know, is it that they were such monopolies that they didn't hire innovators, that they didn't have innovation mindset, and they had a monopoly mindset, for lack of a better way to say it, that they sort of got caught surprised when it wasn't a surprise? I mean, the first reports of decline and fragmentation were many, many years ago.
In the 70s, I think, 80s, yeah.
And even today, many print papers haven't adapted. So
yeah,
the way it's starting to feel is that fragmentation that will never be undone. You can't put that genie back. But the novelty of that, I think, is starting to wear off because people have been inundated with mediocre content for so long.
Sure.
that now the true value is certainly in the specificness of the content, which is where the fragmentation comes in. If I'm into, you know, crafting, I'm not going to go to the newspaper for that. I'm going to spend all my attention on crafting specific or tennis specific entity. But you know, now we're seeing a proliferation of more intense paywalls and raised subscription rates because there's sort of a bounce back to caring about that quality and what being willing to pay for it. And so the model is shifting away from advertiser, maybe more towards consumers paying for it.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Memberships, you know, there are a lot of experiments out there. I think there was the hope and probably the naive hope that the experiments that were underway would lead to a reconstitution of a revenue model that would allow journalism to grow, allow news organizations anyway to grow rather than to shrink. And boy, we haven't seen, so there's no formula. Now, I think the New York Times and the Washington Post under Jeff Bezos' ownership, I think the Wall Street Journal, there are other traditional news organizations that seem to be thriving. But what do those have in common? They have audiences well beyond their geographic communities. And I think this is something that I think your work is trying to attend to this. And so I want to kind of see if I can describe a little theoretically a set of sort of technological and media circumstances. And so when I came here, for example, there was a great rivalry between the St. Petersburg Times and the Tampa Tribune. You had these twin cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, and they both were served by decent newspapers. I would say that in my time, the Times was always consistently better, but the Tribune served its community well. And people in Tampa who knew they could get a, I don't know, better newspaper if they bought the St. Petersburg Times weren't interested. Why? Because the Times didn't cover Tampa the way the Tribune covered it. So there was this sense of identity with the newspaper and the place. What happens in the digital world, I think, is that, and I'd be interested in your take on this, is in the digital world, I've argued that the digital world is sort of extraterrestrial. I don't mean like space aliens, but one of its values is that it's not bounded by trucks that deliver things. That I can read, you know, part of my family is from Providence, Rhode Island. I went to Providence College. I can get all the Providence College news I want for free, you know. So this is something that we have to think about a lot. Think about communities that exist within geographic boundaries that have common interests, sometimes narrow interests. The question is, how can the news interests of those smaller geographical communities be served when the news, traditional news organizations are losing ground rather than gaining it? I think it's a really interesting and important question.
It's a complex question. And I think that part of it is that it changes the nature of the news collection. I mean, how you collect, but I mean the curation of the news, what you choose to write about. I think that there's a certain, we'll call it a growth of knowledge, growth of expertise, which, you know, things that I might be interested in professionally or personally, I'm going to get deeper and more valuable information from sources that are not geographically near me.
Yeah.
And while historically we may have gone to the news because we didn't have other outlets for growing that expertise, and we sort of became a more passive recipient of the publication's choice of that type of information to give us. And that might be human interest stories about Bali or, you know, travel stories or whatever. And so now that power, that's one of the effects of the internet, is that power has come back to the people to go and find that specific kind of information. Mm-hmm. But what that kind of information or those outlets can give you, to your point, is that local connection. And what social media has brought up is connection to people and people's voices. And so what we're trying to do with the Catalyst is kind of the hybrid of that. So we're looking at the specific genre of news that is relevant to people here,
sure,
that they can't get elsewhere, which is why we're not covering much Trump. We're not covering much, you know, many, because we can't do that on a small scale, which is what I think the Times is still trying to do,
yeah,
though they are reprinting a lot of Wall Street Journal stuff or whatever.
Sure.
And so we're recognizing where we can add value and what specific tranches of information are uniquely available to us that aren't better served by people with deeper pockets, you know, more experienced resources and things like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
So I think it's finding that right mix of local relevance and playing there as powerfully as you can without trying to water down, you know, based on some sort of antiquated concept of what a newspaper needs to be from a comprehensiveness standpoint.
So people now talk about, have you heard the term like news deserts? News desert is a place where maybe there once was a newspaper and it went out of business.
Right.
And there's no newspaper there now. I'm trying to think of an example. I think it's Ann Arbor at one time. I'm not sure about that. Or a place that was once served by a daily newspaper that now only publishes less frequently, which I think is maybe a wave of the future, a kind of an evolution of the newspaper as maybe not a daily habit, but something that you get once or twice a week that really gives you more comprehensive view. But whatever happens in those regards, I think every community should find a way to, I don't know, get its shit together and have a conversations about what the news needs are in St. Petersburg. Not just St. Petersburg, Gulfport, Tarpon Springs, right? Carrollwood, Nassau County, Long Island, where I grew up. In other words, these places, there's some similarities and many differences between these communities, and they all don't need the same kind of news. So the question then is, if public-spirited people from different institutions could come together and somehow articulate what they need, then the next question is, okay, if that's our news need, how do we grow our news capacity? And the catalyst would be an example of an addition to the news capacity of this community where we live and where we're raising our families. And I think we have a problem of the digital age, social media, in spite of, I think, naive projections that these technologies would give us a new enlightened form of discourse. Well, yes, some of that, but sadly, as we know, how polluted, you know, that digital ocean is in some regards. So what is journalism for? It's never been for its own sake. It's been always attached to the idea of self-government, something that Nelson Poynter articulated very, very clearly. He said this, that his primary duty was not to his family members to get more wealthy, not to the stockholders to get more wealthy, not to the advertisers, but to the readers. And that idea is born of, you know, very inspiring, some ways traditional ideas of self-government, that which Rick am I going to vote for in the mayoral election, right? I think you need to some knowledge in order to make that decision. And where are you going to get it?
You get it from the platform. I think the specificity of any line of expertise of any career now is such a degree of magnitude more complex and more intense. And you know, there's people that study the left wing of a bumblebee for their entire career, and they have unmatched expertise in that. And that's, you know, issues like offshore drilling and any of those things, there are people that have that level of expertise. So, you know, you can try to write about that and hold your objectivity theoretically through the writer. People don't buy that anymore. Plus, you then water down the expertise because you're coming through a proxy, right? You're trying to deliver that information through a proxy. So the ideal is then, you know, and this is again what the Catalyst aspires to be, is to have the people who are the experts in the left wing of the bumblebee put the piece up there. And if there's a counterpiece to that, to have the people put the counterpiece up there. And, you know, then what you lose in that is, you know, if you feel like the hospital is doing the wrong thing and it's the hospital CEO who's putting the information out there, maybe that's fluff, maybe that's spin. But I think, you know, there's negatives to any way you do it. And I think the idea that you can counter the fluff and the spin through the platform, which is a platform that expects objectivity, that challenges its writers and will not put pieces up, which again brings back in the subjectivity, but generally challenges the author to adhere to this and to be solutions-based versus build up versus tear down.
Mm-hmm.
Just the subtle philosophies that you can build in there that, you know, don't cure it, but make it, to me, a more ideal situation. I would much rather hear from the CEO than a reporter. That being said, there are things that you can't get without crossing over multiple stakeholders and stories. And,
sure,
you know, one of the big downfalls that happen in these media deserts is that a lot of civic action goes unchecked, right?
That's
not reported on. And so then things start to go off the rails a little bit if nobody's watching, right? So,
yeah,
you know, that does bring back in that element, which, you know, but one of the things that was taken for granted when the media had pretty much, they were the sole source of attention was, you know, it was for the reader's benefit. But now we actually, by losing that, we have to introduce a community benefit as well.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the places that, you know, many of the boards and initiatives that I'm involved in, the ideas are fantastic. And the, you know, the barrier to making those things happen is information dissemination. You just don't, enough people don't know about it. And we had Randy Russell in, you know, we talked about, in, for example, they essentially have pills now that will keep AIDS at bay in, or HIV at bay indefinitely. But the infection rate is still out of control because the information and the, that mindset and that information hasn't made it to the places where it needs to.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to see that just having the cure isn't enough anymore. Getting the information out about that cure is just half the battle. And so I think that's somewhat introduced, you know, a new challenge for journalism.
Sure.
Which then kind of brings back the idea that you need a place that people have incentive to go or a way to distribute that, which is, you know, when again, I think you look at what's the most ubiquitous platform for that now is social media.
Mm-hmm.
So mixing that, you know, which is user contributed. So mixing those two platforms, which is, you know, again, goes back to people making the news, contributing it, changes the nature of the entity from a news source to a platform,
mm-hmm.
which hopefully will, you know, incentivize people to the same way social media incentivizes them. So mixing those motivations to gain that audience back, you know, again, is how I'm starting to see the future of media.
Yeah. I think it's very much worth me sharing the news, which I think some people in the community understand that I think it'd be fair to identify St. Petersburg as the center of a revolution in journalism in which systematic fact-checking has become increasingly important, to some extent sort of influential. The Poynter Institute is now the home for PolitiFact, which still publishes its work in the Tampa Bay Times. And we have teachers at Poynter now, such as Alexios Marsalis, who's from Italy, who's been at Poynter now for, I think, going on 3 years, who travels the world far and wide in order to train fact checkers and to try to help people develop the skills and disciplines that allows them to take a statement made by a leader in the community and to test it, you know, against the evidence. And we know in the current political environment, the status of facts and evidence is so shaky. And I think that's a problem. I think whatever your platform is, right? I mean, you have a duty not to some philosophical notion of the truth, but I would call it duty to the practical truth. And people seem to look at facts, or what they describe as facts, as means rather than ends. So whatever their political goal is, you know, they're bending or shape or spinning or distorting the evidence to support an ideology across the political spectrum. So we need competing forces, checks and balances that are going to help people make sense of information that's flooding over them indiscriminately.
Honestly, I think the bigger challenge to that is that it's sometimes multiple things can be true based on the perspective from which you look at them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll go back to offshore drilling, something that we were with Senator Bill Nelson yesterday. And if you look at it from an environmental risk standpoint, it means one thing to you. If you look at it from an economic impact standpoint, that means another thing to you. And both of those are true. It will have this economic impact, and it does introduce this risk. And so, you know, again, one of the goals that we have in putting forth these things, trying to be an objective platform, is that it seems to me that certain media outlets will attract readers who are looking at it from the perspective of the environmental impact. And other media outlet may attract readers we're looking at it from the economic impact perspective, and those two will never meet in the middle because they're looking at it from different perspectives. So the idea is, one of the challenges is handling duplicity. I don't know that there is, there are truths that are the same thing. If you look at the Mona Lisa from the back, it looks different than if you look at it from the front. I don't know if that's the right example. Yeah. But, and so weeding those out and acknowledging all of those aspects and then making the decision. I think if you can get people to understand the issues with open-mindedness from multiple perspectives, then you've won a lot of the battle.
A strategy that we've taught on and off going back to the 1990s with the experimentation in what was called the civic journalism, republic journalism movement, which was arguing for a greater balance in problem-focused journalism and solution-focused journalism. And the idea is that a news organization should not just inform the public, but in some cases, form the public. Mm-hmm. In other words, to create a solution. So there's a really bad problem, and I'm a journalist, and I write about the problem at this elementary school, and I publish it widely, and people read it, and nothing happens. Do my responsibilities stop there? I said, well, you know, I did my best.
Yep.
So there's conversation about that. And there's a name, or at least I think of a name for what you're talking about. And it's not so much like truth telling, alternate facts. It's framing is a useful strategic approach to this. So, for example, everybody knows you look into a camera lens. The frame on that image can be narrow or can be wide. When you see it narrowly, you see one thing. When you see it wider, you see another thing. If you shift the focus, you may see a different reality, a different sort of experience. And so I think if we applied that to almost all of our problems, such as immigration, mm-hmm. you know, I want our borders to be secure. I do. I don't want to throw 11 million people out of the country, turn the United States into a police state. So there are these competing frames. And if people are willing to have conversations and have interactions, both in real space and in virtual space, I think that that's an ideal for how a community can gather and use the news it needs.
Wonderful. I look forward to continuing this conversation, and I appreciate you stopping by.
My pleasure. It was great to meet the doggies.